One of the questions that is particularly pertinent is what limits cognitive control? What makes us so limited? Why do we fail so often to exert control?
So we've got dopamine solved, right?
Do we? I mean, it's so horrendously complex, these systems. It's unlikely that with thinking, we deplete some kind of metabolic resource in the brain. At least we haven't discovered what that metabolic resource will be.
This is Brain Inspired.
Hey, welcome everyone. This is Paul Middlebrooks, and today my guest is Roshan Cools. So Roshan runs the Motivational and Cognitive Control Lab. She's at the Donders Institute for Brain, Cognition, and Behavior. She's also a professor of cognitive neuropsychiatry, and this is all at Radboud University in the Netherlands. In her lab, she largely studies how neurotransmitters, or brain chemicals, affect our higher cognitive functions like motivation and cognitive control. So on the show, she talks about cognitive control as a meta-control function, that is, controlling how we go about deciding whether and when to spend cognitive effort versus going on a sort of autopilot. Not just in our actions that involve motor responses, but also in our thoughts that involve functions like working memory. This can be thought of as a trade-off between stability and flexibility, or maintaining a state of focus versus allowing new information to enter when it's necessary, like when you're changing the task that you're working on, and so on. And we talk about the story of dopamine, which is all the rage in the reinforcement learning world, and a well-known part of that story in neuroscience. So we discuss that well-known story of dopamine, but Roshan and others' work has shown that dopamine is involved in cognitive control as well, and we discuss its involvement therein. Roshan is the second guest I've had who will be giving a keynote address at the Cognitive Computational Neuroscience Conference in a few months. And you can learn more about that at ccneuro.org. It's going to be an awesome conference, so you should submit a paper and attend, is my suggestion. We talk about what she'll talk about in her keynote address at CCN. We also talk about how AI is, you know, just starting to pay attention to neuromodulators and their function. Speak a little bit about being a woman in science, and a lot more, of course. And, of course, you can find the show notes with links to whatever comes out of our mouths during the show at braininspired.co/podcast/36. Okay, thanks for listening. This show continues to be a joyful challenge for me. Getting to talk with people like Roshan just makes it so worth it to me. And I hope it is joyfully challenging you. And I'm wishing you the perfect balance of dopamine in your brains. Well, please enjoy. Roshan Cools. Roshan, thank you for joining me on the show today.
Hi, Paul. Thank you for having me.
I could go full on Dutch and go, Roshan, Roshan. But you've already corrected me and just told me to say Roshan. So I will.
Very good.
So you run the Motivational and Cognitive Control Lab at the Donders Institute for Brain, Cognition, and Behavior and the Center for Cognitive Neuroimaging. And this is at Radboud University. Speaking of where you work, I had Marcel van Gerven on the show, 2 months ago. Do you and he cross paths often?
Oh, yeah, regularly. We haven't collaborated yet, I would say. But yeah, we share sessions and the Donders is kind of unique for its collaborative atmosphere. So we see each other regularly. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Well, good. He was fun to talk to, actually. So tell him I said hi. And
okay.
There's someone else you should say hi to. My friend, Bram Zandbelt, who works for you. So I knew Bram. We were postdocs together at Vanderbilt University. And I know that Brahms and his family are huge fans of Zwarte Piet, or Black Pete. the crown jewel of the Netherlands.
So. Right. Is that right? Yeah. Well, it's a sensitive issue, you know.
I hear. That's what I understand. Well, tell us who Black Piet is, or Zwarte Piet.
Oh, well, Zwarte Piet, although we're not really supposed to refer to him as Zwarte Piet now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And
yeah.
In fact, they are often pink or yellow or white or any color, but they are the helpers of St. Nicholas. And St. Nicholas visits us every year on the 5th of December on his birthday from Spain, and he comes with a boat full of little gifts for all the kids, and the kids sing.
This is Sinterklaas.
Sinterklaas, yeah. Yes. That's right. And his Black Piets, that's the story. But there's a lot of uproar about that now in the Netherlands. So
sort of famously, there are a bunch of people that walk around in blackface, dressed up as Black Piet, right?
And that's right.
And is that the controversy?
Yeah, that is the controversy.
Yeah.
And then half of the country is thinking that this is sort of a ridiculous worry, because clearly he's black because he has to go through the fireplace to get to the fireplace.
Oh,
that's why he's black.
He's covered in soot. Oh my gosh.
Yes.
I didn't know that. Okay.
But and it's like a tradition. So people are upset about this being now no longer allowed. But the other half of the country, or maybe the majority, I'm not sure about the proportion, is thinking that it's time to update this tradition and that we can no longer sort of work with this old model where the helpers really represent, you know, slaves from Africa who would help Sinterklaas to bring the gifts. So,
well, I guess there is some sort of balance between tradition and progress. And part of what we're going to talk today is about balance with dopamine in the system. So maybe that's a good segue to move on here.
That's right. That's right.
So your main focus, Roshan, is on the major neuromodulators like dopamine and serotonin in the brain, and how they affect our motivation and our cognitive control, or willpower, if you will, and what's happening when these neuromodulators are non-optimal in situations like Parkinson's disease and so on. And lately, if I have this right, you've been focused on bringing two stories about dopamine together. One is the story about dopamine in a reward-based choice, and the other story is the story of dopamine in cognitive control. And we'll talk about what all that means throughout the show here. But would you like to add to what I just said about what you do?
No, I think that's pretty accurate. So we have an interest quite broadly in these ascending neuromodulators, and most of the work is focused on dopamine, but there's also a parallel line of work on serotonin, which might provide an interesting motivational opponent, some have argued, of dopamine. And of course, our interest also kind of broadened out to the other systems, such as noradrenaline, but most of my empirical work and also my thinking is focused on dopamine, so that's right.
So, yeah, this is a world, you know, that the chemicals in the brain is a world that I'm, you know, not well versed in. Can we just, before we really kind of get into things, can we just zoom way out and think about neuromodulators for a second from an evolutionary perspective here? So AI these days, like deep neural networks, really doesn't incorporate neuromodulators into their works. I mean, there's very, very, very little work being done on this. And I'm sure I'm going to get backlash for saying that. But like deep learning nets, you know, or neural networks or whatever, they start with neurons or neural units as the basic unit of computation. Now, way back before there were multicellular organisms, you had these single-celled organisms, you know, swimming around in this bath, you know, and they communicated via chemicals that they would excrete, or chemicals in the environment, or that they would secrete. Okay, and then so fast forward, and the single-celled organisms become multicellular organisms, and chemicals are still the rule. Within the organism, cells are still communicating via chemicals. And now in nervous systems, chemicals are still the rule. You know, even the action potentials are mediated via chemicals in the synapse. So that's kind of a long introduction to ask, is it off base to think of neuromodulators as communication signals between cells that have since been kind of co-opted to modulate the activity of like a little population of cells, you know, like a population of neurons, right? Or what is the right way to think about this from an evolutionary perspective?
I think that's actually quite a good way of thinking about it. So it's important to make a distinction between these classic neurotransmitters that transmit these messages between neurons and these large ascending chemical neuromodulators,
yeah,
which really serve as a mechanism of dynamics. So these systems, these networks in themselves with their connections are fairly fixed. Of course, both biological and artificial networks, they have to adapt to our environment. So the way I think about these neuromodulators is that they allow us to adapt and they allow the system to adapt flexibly to the constantly changing environment. And they do that because of a variety of reasons, but they indeed provide a way for these neurons to communicate that I think we should start thinking about in AI indeed. And people have started, of course.
So this is a bit of a different show for me, you know, because we usually jump right into the AI discussion, you know. So, and hopefully we can talk a little bit about that. But we're going to spend some time talking about your research and also talk about things related to the Cognitive Computational Neuroscience Conference, where you'll be delivering a keynote talk many moons from now in September in Berlin. So, Roshan, you gave a great TED talk a few years ago about the need for society to trust science, and especially basic discovery-based science, arguing that some of the greatest advancements in science have resulted not by trying to advance a particular thing, you know, like you're working on the problem to advance and then you advance it, but rather that they emerge from the work being done out of curiosity about other things. So I encourage people to check that out. Of course, I'll link to it in the show notes. But what I want to ask is, what is it like giving a TED talk? Is it just another talk, or is it a completely different experience, or what?
Well, it's a completely different experience, really. I mean, the whole preparation for, of course, it was a TEDx talk, right? There's
right?
a difference between these TEDx talks and
sure,
TED talks.
But it's the same format, right?
That's right. And it involved the kind of serious preparation and training. there's lots of rules, right? You have to stand on the circle and you're not supposed to move much. And yeah, there's hardly any slides. And there's an extensive, you know, review of the actual text. Yeah, it's very controlled.
Oh, so you memorize the text and you really go... I mean, you have to, because you have to finish in time and the timing has to be right and all that jazz.
Exactly. Yeah. But even the way you have to stand is like regulated.
How do you have to stand? We'll just talk about that.
Yeah, you can't move.
So
the rule is to stay still. And so there was a number of training sessions.
God, talk about cognitive control.
In which I was told not to move my hands. Yeah, exactly. Well, it's physical control as well as cognitive control.
Well, that's good distinction that we'll get into here. And also, and I'm trying to convince my wife of this still. I don't know why it's hard to convince her, but at the beginning of TED Talks, when you watch online, they put a clap track at the beginning. As I said, everyone's giving you a standing ovation before you speak. And so no, people aren't giving you a standing ovation before you speak, are they?
No.
So you're going to give a keynote lecture here in a few months at the CCN. I know it's really early to ask this, but do you have... broadly, some possible topics that you'll be talking about there?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the plan is to talk about this observation that the human brain faces a number of these trade-offs that I've talked about previously, these computational trade-offs, such as the one between focus and flexibility, make the observation that these large ascending neuromodulatory systems are particularly well suited to regulate these trade-offs dynamically. And I will make that point by illustrating a number of general principles of chemical neuromodulation, like baseline dependency, opponency, and, you know, regional specificity. But that's a very abstract summary, I guess.
Yeah.
More concretely, I'll present some of our recent work in which we've combined pharmacology and chemical PET, in which we measure dopamine directly in the brain using these radio tracers, in terms of uptake of tracers, as well as fMRI, using a number of cognitive tasks and model-based analyses. So it's that combination of techniques that we apply to the overarching question, which is really a cognitive one, and which is what limits human cognition. So that's really my ultimate interest, curiosity, is about what makes us fail to exert cognitive control so often? What makes our ability to exert control so limited, despite the prefrontal cortex, which is associated with that ability, being so well developed, right?
Right. So, I mean, at the conference, your specialization really is, like you just said, coming from more of a cognitive neuroscience side. And you'll be presenting at this conference where they're trying to bring together, you know, cognitive science, neuroscience, and artificial intelligence. Do you have a sense of how these three sort of disciplines can best work together?
Yeah, so that's a bit of an abstract question, right?
But sure.
From my perspective, we've been inspired and influenced a lot by people who've built more formal models of some of the ideas we have had, but not worked out so specifically. So in my interactions with modelers and people from AI, I'm inspired and also encouraged to break down the problem in a way that I am not when I interact with other experts, for example, psychiatrists or psychologists or neuroscientists or neuroanatomists or physiologists. So I have several collaborations with people like Michael Frank or more locally here, starting to interact with people from the AI department. And I always feel that this is particularly productive once you actually engage in a direct collaboration on the work floor. So where you really design the experiment, the empirical work together based on formalized theory, and where you actually run these model-based and design and run these model-based analyses together. But I'm not sure that's the answer to your question at the level of
So, I mean, during that kind of collaboration, I mean, collaboration is so important. Do you feel like, for instance, with Michael Frank or, you know, whomever, when you're working with a modeler, is the communication really freely two ways? You know, do you guys inspire each other, or is it more you're learning and they're implementing, or how does the,
No, I think it is really two ways, and the interaction with Michael is maybe quite a nice illustration of that, and also our historical interaction. So we actually first met on a conference when he presented a model of some of our empirical findings in Parkinson's disease, where we showed that dopaminergic medication has these detrimental overdose effects on reversal learning, on this type of flexibility, which he then sort of was inspired by to build this this model, which then was so successful. His work then inspired us to follow up some specific questions in which we addressed using this combination of pharmacology and PET, and we involved him and analyzed some of the work with some RL models. So it's really a two-way interaction, I would say.
Yeah.
And even today, we're running these complex, highly complex pharmacological multimodal imaging projects. And for example, we have a joint postdoc, excellent postdoc, Andrew Westbrook, who spent a year in our lab, who's currently in at Brown in Michael's lab. And we're, you know, on Skype every week, every month with the three of us.
Oh, cool.
And it's a very, I would say it's a very mutual learning experience. We have a different look on things. Yeah, and Michael's not the only person. I interact also with other people. Like, we've done quite a bit of work with Quentin Hughes, and these are quite specific people where I do feel that the ability to lay some empirical foundations under of these theoretical ideas provide this mutual ground.
Yeah, it's like scaffolding to build your own ideas further, and it's a beautiful thing.
But, yeah.
So Is there something that when you attend the CCN in particular, is there something that you feel like you might want to take away from that conference or you're looking forward to?
Well, I guess the question is probably answered in a very similar manner. I mean, what I hope is to get an overview of the current state and to be inspired by. I haven't been previous years.
You know, thinking back to all the conferences that you've been to, and I know you go to even more these days than you have in the past because you're speaking and being invited to them. Can you think of like one of the best quote unquote moments, you know, that you've had at a conference? People talk about scientific moments, right? When you make a discovery and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you think of one of the best moments that you've had at a conference that's really inspired you or led to something?
Oh yeah, I mean, there was a wonderful meeting. I mean, I can give a specific example. Maybe the general point first. Of course, if you go to a meeting with a particular aim, or such as you have a vague a new interest that's sort of vague in a new topic, but you go with that topic in your mind, and for example, SFN, a meeting like SFN is so large, and that's the only way to get anything out.
Yeah.
But I probably had that experience last year when I went there with quite a specific novel interest in the back of my mind. And I felt quite satisfied when I was able to kind of obtain lots of new input on that particular topic. So far, I've focused, as you know, mostly on the costs and benefits of cognitive control. But more recently, I've started to be interested in assessing whether we can begin to leverage commonalities or maybe bridges between this cognitive control field and the cognitive mapping field, better known from spatial navigation and memory.
I just had Tim Behrens on, so this is
Okay, yeah, exactly. Tim's work has very much inspired me recently. And you might be surprised, language. So, So Nijmegen is kind of well known for its large community of linguistic scientists or neurobiology of language. And, you know, after being here for more than 10 years, I'm starting to be influenced by that community.
Just being there.
And that, with that sort of general aim in mind, to see how to bridge these three fields of cognitive control, decision making on the one hand, cognitive mapping on the other hand, and the problem of inference in language, really was sufficiently vague to be easily satisfied with that thing.
But
I can talk a bit more about that. But maybe a much more concrete example of a very defining moment was a conference, little conference organized by Todd Braver, and I can't remember now. It was in Washington, St. Louis.
Yep.
A wonderful meeting on the motivation of cognitive control in 2013. And that now, if I look back, has influenced a lot of my work in the last few years. So actually, Andrew Westbrook, who I just mentioned, who's doing this joint postdoc between Michael and myself, was a PhD student at the time in Todd Braver's lab. And Todd was presenting his interesting novel work on cognitive effort discounting.
In that case, that's a very specific type of conference, but were you, so you were there focused, you know, sort of on your own field, really, right? So did you have like a specific moment where you're like, oh, I see, you know? And
yeah. No, I think that was a defining moment, that meeting where until then I had these parallel lines of work where on the one hand I studied dopamine's role in the prefrontal cortex, working memory, task switching, these kind of higher order cognitive processes, was influenced a lot by these attractor landscape models of prefrontal dopamine. And on the other hand, this work on reinforcement learning and the basal ganglia. And I think it was probably around that time that I thought, maybe it's worth to think about these two roles of dopamine in the striatum and the prefrontal cortex and to integrate them and to consider that dopamine might well contribute to these higher order cognitive functions by acting somewhat indirectly on the basal ganglia to alter the weight on the costs and benefits of cognitive control. To some degree, that point had been made much earlier, of course, by Randy O'Reilly and Thomas Hasey and Michael Frank in their gating models of working memory. But to me, that importance of that point and the need to study it empirically became so clear at that moment.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, man, this, I want to just start talking about that stuff, but and we'll get there. But so CCN is a smaller conference, and you're headed to, are you flying out today or tomorrow to go to Brown?
Yeah, tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Yeah. You're flying out tomorrow to go to an even smaller conference, I believe, specifically on cognitive control. And the moment of inspiration you were just describing happened at a small conference. So, I mean, what, you know, is there something special about like a smaller conference relative to something like Society for Neuroscience, where you have 20,000 neuroscientists there?
Yeah, of course, lots. The one thing is that it allows you to focus, I think. Mm-hmm. So, at SFN, I tend to want to absorb everything that I can on all the topics.
God. Yeah.
The opportunity cost is super high, right? So it's impossible to focus. At these smaller meetings, you can have a conversation and actually let it flow somewhat freely and not be stressed about all the things that you're missing out on.
Yeah.
I think it's really about opportunity cost that's less salient in this smaller meeting, that's lower.
Yeah.
As you can focus a bit.
I'm also really on the introvert scale, and I know there's a lot of ongoing research about introversion, extroversion, but in a situation like Society for Neuroscience, I tend to just give up really quickly. Like you start to sort of wander the posters, and then from 20 feet back, you think, I don't want to engage in that because that could. That's 30. It could be 30 minutes. Does that look like a 30-minute engagement of my time? No, you wander on, and then you just give up at a certain point.
Yeah. That's why it only works if you have this higher order goal in mind, which can sculpt your selection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a quick break, relax your brain for a second. Raunach, Alex, Adam, and NN_MM. Thanks, guys, for deciding to support the show through Patreon and continuing to keep me dedicated to figuring out what the hell we're all talking about anyway, and hopefully inspiring you in some way along your journey. All right, time to flip your cognitive control back into focused mode. Okay, cool. Well, Roshan, I want to know about how to improve my cognitive control, and I'm hoping that you can help me here today. So what is cognitive control, and how, I mean, I know you've contributed to changing its definition over the years and recently, and so what is it, and how has its definition changed?
Yeah, cognitive control is an ill-defined phenomenon, but generally refers to that set of mental processes that enable us to obtain our goals by resisting distractions and temptations and impulses. Your question, whether the construct has changed, yes and no. I think one observation that we made is that control, exerting control, can be both good and bad. And so too much control is no good, depending on the statistics of the environment. Too much focus, too much stability, if you will, is inappropriate if the environment is very volatile, if there's lots of new input that needs to be processed, that require adaptation of behavior. So at that level, too much cognitive control, if we define it in terms of focus, is inadequate. Of course, we could argue that what we need is a form of meta-level cognitive control.
Okay.
And if we define cognitive control at that higher order level, you could argue that too much control is never inappropriate.
Because you're right? By meta, you mean a controller for the cognitive control. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, if we define our goal in terms of optimal adaptation to a changing environment, then we can't have too much cognitive control. So I'm interested actually to hear, Paul, what makes you think that I've contributed to changing the definition?
So you've written about how in the past cognitive control has all been about implementing the control aspect. And what you've done, from what I understand, has you've broadened it to include the flexibility aspect and mm-hmm. part of and brought that sort of within the definition of cognitive control. And yeah. you can correct me if I'm wrong on that. But you've taken it from where it's cognitive control, where, you know, we're all Dutch and all we want is just focus, right? And you've brought it out of the Dutch realm. So, you know, I've heard you talk about how much control you like and how much control Europeans tend to like and how important focus and productivity and things like that are culturally. But really, the other half of control is being able to relinquish that control and bring in the new information. So,
yeah, so that's at a higher level, I would say.
I see.
Than the type of control that we classically measure, I would say, in the lab, for example, with classic cognitive control tests of Stroop or Erickson Flinker. What this discussion really illustrates is the need to be much more precise in the use of our terms, right?
Yeah, well, that's always the case, yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess it's always the case, but here this illustrates quite nicely, I think, the use of this formal modeling approach to some of these issues. Yes, we could specify cognitive control in terms of its meta-level requirement as being aimed at the higher-order goal of adapting to a changing environment. And it is true that our kind of insights that what we need is an ability to dynamically regulate whether we're focused or whether we're flexible that might have contributed to this redefinition of cognitive control.
What do you think the most critical or one of the most critical open questions is about cognitive control and or this meta, what do we call it?
Meta decision making, meta control. I would say that one of the questions that is particularly pertinent is what limits cognitive control? What makes us so limited? Why do we fail so often to exert control? And it's not a trivial question, as I said earlier, I believe. We consider control, cognitive control, as a hallmark of the human brain. It's associated with this kind of very well-developed part of the brain. So why don't we use it all the time? The other point to make here is that in contrast to effortful physical control, effortful mental control, cognitive control, is unlikely to be easily accounted for by depletion of some kind of metabolic resource. At least, you know, the increase in bolt signal when people perform complex cognitive tasks in the scanner is equivalent to the increase in bolt signal in the default mode network when we are at rest, for example, or when we conduct a simple visual task that in itself is not experienced, accompanied by an experience of mental effort. So what makes us fatigued? What's the origin of mental fatigue and what is the cost of cognitive control is really a related question to what limits cognitive control. And I think that's a tough question. And I think the answer to that question might lie in a better understanding of these chemical neuromodulatory systems.
This is a fascinating. I mean, I think every topic we talk about, I'm gonna want to jump off and say, you know, how this could relate to AI systems, you know, and then we go off on, because it's sort of fascinating how computer systems would compare, you know, how model AI systems would compare. But to address this, you know, this limitation, why we get fatigue, you know, what do you think we need more of or better of? You know, is it the technology? Do we need better technology? Do we need more data, better models, you know, theories or something else? I mean, I know we need all of it, but if you had to push for one.
Yeah, I would say, so as I pointed out, I think these chemical neuromodulatory systems are likely to play a key role and to provide an answer in part to this question. But many of these ideas out there are fairly underspecified. Mm. So I think the first thing that's really needed here is more formal theories, formal models that then generate predictions that we can test with new techniques. PET is the only way to measure these systems in the human brain and SPECT, but their spatial and temporal resolution is just horrifyingly low. Of course, people are starting to measure signals at a higher temporal scale with voltammetry, for example. Mm. Reed Montague's published some really interesting work on that, where measuring chemical signals from patients with Parkinson's disease. If we start to be able to do that more broadly, I think that has promise, and to manipulate it. But that's, of course, a far future. But if you ask me what's needed, then I think it's a combination of, yeah, investment in this formal modeling of these ideas, plus advances in measurement and manipulation techniques of these neurochemical systems. Because both pharmacology and PET are so coarse.
Yeah.
We really suffer from that, yeah.
Is it so interesting to talk about these amazing technologies and how terrible they are?
Yeah.
Yeah. If I had to freeze you, right, if you were going to be cryogenically frozen for a certain amount of time and then you'd wake up, how long would you want to be frozen for?
That's a great question.
And you can say a day, I suppose, but given what you just said, I imagine it's more than a day.
Yeah, in terms of scientific advance. Yeah.
Well,
I wouldn't want to be frozen at all from the perspective of my kids.
Yeah, your kids. Controlling for your children.
Yeah. I would say probably 10 years or so.
Oh, wow. That's optimistic. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But as I say, I mean, there are people already measuring these temporally very precise signals, not directly, in a model-based manner. You know, there's some inference involved there. We're going fast, I think. Manipulating those systems at that scale, that's a whole different issue.
Yeah.
But there's some very interesting new stimulation techniques out there which might be promising too.
Well, in humans especially, which is your specialization. So cognitive control, like we mentioned a few minutes ago, or I mentioned, I suppose, used to be all about implementing control and maintaining focus, you know, and the more the better. And your work has shown that there's a balance needed between that stability of maintaining, the stability of maintaining focus in your working memory and in your attention when you're doing these cognitively demanding tasks, and instability, or, you know, what we can call flexibility. What is the right balance between stability and flexibility?
Yeah, well, there's no sort of answer, straightforward answer to that. That depends on the statistics of the environment. So if we're in a world with very many rewarding alternative opportunities, then it's not adaptive, probably. It's not optimal to constantly focus on one task. If the world is very volatile, then also we need to be more flexible than if the world around us is quite stable. So the degree to which we need to invest in one versus the other strategy really depends on all these metaparameters. So volatility, controllability, I would say average reward rate. There's all kinds of aspects of the environment that determine whether one state is better than the other.
But you wouldn't want to be, okay, so, I mean, we can talk more about this, and we'll talk about prefrontal cortex and the basal ganglia, the striatum, and how they interact to potentially provide these mechanisms. You wouldn't want to be, you don't want to be switching tasks every 30 seconds, for instance. That's unhealthy, right? What I'm wondering at, and maybe I can wait to ask this, is so you're focused on a task, right? And even if you're in an environment where the statistics are such that you should be really flexible, so the mechanism of switching of flexibility shouldn't come online and like stay online, right? It should kind of come online, and then you should switch tasks and focus, and that should be like the prolonged state. Does that make any sense? That's actually a question.
So I'm not quite sure I'm following exactly what you're saying, but I think what you're saying is that we should be to some degree flexible and stable at the same time.
Well, so the flexibility aspect is good for switching, right?
Right.
It's bringing in new information, but then you want to bring in that new information and then clamp down. And you don't want to be bringing in new information for 3 days, right, before you clamp down. So I'm envisioning a system where you're focused on something and then, oh, it's time to bring in new information and potentially switch tasks or whatever. And then you sort of open up the ability to be flexible, but briefly, then again, focus. And
That's right.
That seems like the right balance to me, but am I off base there?
No, absolutely not. I think that's absolutely true that we would want to continue to keep certain representations online and then occasionally sort of gate new information in. So
yeah, that's the gating work that you were talking about earlier with the basal ganglia. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe let's move on and we'll come back to this. So many of my listeners likely hear the word dopamine. And they think, that's the reinforcement learning chemical, you know, related to when we get an unexpected reward or we think we're going to get an reward, but we don't, the old prediction error. But I imagine few of my listeners have heard it in relation to cognitive control. Could you, for us all, just give the quick and dirty overview of dopamine in reinforcement learning, sort of like the quote-unquote classic now story of dopamine, and then talk about how it's, you know, about its role in cognitive control?
Yeah, so actually, like years ago, maybe in the 50s, 40s, we didn't consider dopamine to have a cognitive role at all.
Right.
This was changed in part by the seminal work of Patricia Goldman-Rakic and Brzozowski, showing that depletion of the prefrontal cortex leads to a deficit on delayed response, like classic delayed response tasks, classic tasks of working memory,
right,
to almost the same degree as those seen after complete ablations of the prefrontal cortex. Those were the first sort of pieces of evidence suggesting that dopamine does something else than being involved in motor control. And that was long before the RL story of dopamine, although there was the soon, not that long after, the pleasure story. And
yes, the happy drug.
The
self-administration
work. And of course, the success of the dopamine RL story is very much grounded in the theoretical work by Peter Dayan and Reid Montague, who kind of observed that the signals that were so famously recorded by Wolfram Schultz from these dopamine neurons, which were active at the time of an unexpected reward, and which were depressed at the time of the omission of an expected reward, were so similar or basically resembled that reward prediction error that played such an important role in these learning theories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they made that observation that dopamine might carry this learning signal and therefore, and be important in reinforcing behavior rather than simply serving as a pleasure signal.
And I would say in the vast, vast majority of when dopamine comes up related to AI networks and you know, deep learning networks, it is in this context of the early reinforcement learning theories and work.
Yeah.
So we've got dopamine solved, right?
Do we? I mean, it's so horrendously complex, these systems, right? Okay, we have this interesting RL signal that we can detect from neurons. I think that probably is accepted now by everyone, although, of course, there's also a lot of heterogeneity, even at the level of the midbrain.
You mean among individuals?
Between individuals, but also within individuals. Like, there's neurons that show this reward prediction error signal, but there's also neurons who show a rather different signal.
Mm.
So there's still ongoing debate about the degree to which there is some structure in that heterogeneity.
And you think 10 years? You think 10 years is when you'd want to wake up, huh?
Yeah, because I think there's lots of interesting movement going on right now.
Sure, you wouldn't be doing it otherwise.
I don't want to miss that. But the point is that signal that is well known at the level of the midbrain, projects to all these different regions, and these different regions have different ways of subsequently metabolizing the dopamine. So in the prefrontal cortex, for example, metabolism is really slow. So there's no way of that temporally precise signal, prediction error signal, to be conserved. It's very hard for that temporal precision to be translated at the level of the prefrontal cortex. Dopamine is metabolized by COMS rather than the dopamine transporter, which is much more abundant in the striatum. So that already shows that the effects really depend on the target region.
This might be the right time to bring in the prefrontal cortex and the striatum story and how it relates to what we know about what you know about dopamine and its role in cognitive control. And I know this is an ongoing story, but what is the prefrontal cortex and striatum story with respect to dopamine and cognitive control?
Yeah, so really the observation that we made and others as well is that people have thought about dopamine's contributions to working memory and cognitive control in two relatively segregated sort of communities. So there's this group of people who've thought about dopamine's contributions to working memory in terms of a modulation of an energy landscape, if you will, or the gain in an attractor landscape, changing the depth of these energy wells by increasing dopamine and also noradrenaline. By the way, we change the signal to noise ratio of these working memory representations, of these prefrontal memory networks, as a result of which the kind of relevant or the most active representation becomes potentiated and amplified in the context of suppression of kind of irrelevant working memory representations.
Well, so is it suppression of the noise, or is it amplification of the gain, or both?
So the way that people have thought about this is an increase, if you will, of the depth of the well of these energy.
Okay.
As a result of which it is more difficult to change this representation given new input. So it's less likely that new input will impact prefrontal networks.
I see.
This is work by Dershowitz and Siemens. And then in parallel, that there's this kind of alternative class of models, which has talked about dopamine's contributions to working memory and has thought about these contributions in terms of a modulation of a gate, if you will. So it's altering the selection of new input or new representations or the suppression of old representations rather than altering the memory of existing representations.
And a lot of like what you have proposed and a lot and what you're working on is how, well, for instance, if you take a healthy individual and let's say they have low dopamine in the basal ganglia, like a baseline low level of dopamine in the basal ganglia, but they have normal levels of dopamine in the prefrontal cortex, you know, for whatever reason. Let's say this is a healthy individual. And then you just give them dopamine. It's going to affect them differently than if they had low levels of dopamine in prefrontal cortex, but high levels in basal ganglia and so on and so forth. So what is that story of how dopamine and the different levels in different areas of our brain can affect our cognitive control?
Yeah, so there's two general observations that we've made. The first is that a dopaminergic drug that increases receptor stimulation will have quite different effects depending on the baseline state. So if the baseline state is low, it will improve the function of that region. If it is high, it might overdose the function of that region. Now, the other observation, and we've touched on that just before, is that the effect will depend very much on where in the brain it acts. So if we have a system with high levels in prefrontal cortex and low levels in the basal ganglia, we might increase the function of the basal ganglia, but detrimentally overdose the function of the prefrontal cortex. And sort of the reverse story might apply to a system with low levels of prefrontal cortex, but high levels of the basal ganglia. So this has been a kind of an oversimplified way of thinking about, for example, Parkinson's disease, where dopamine levels are severely depleted in the striatum early on, but actually are relatively intact in the prefrontal cortex. If you increase dopamine, we might see an increase in cognitive flexibility by increases in dopamine in the striatum, in the basal ganglia. But at the same time, that same drug might detrimentally overdose the prefrontal cortex, which was relatively intact to begin with, right, and thereby interfere with a key role for dopamine in that prefrontal cortex, which is the stabilization of working memory representations. And this is at least what we see empirically, is that dopaminergic drugs make people more flexible. They can switch between tasks more readily. And we've seen that that kind of effect is associated with modulation of the basal ganglia. Huh. But at the same time, you see that that same medication can make people actually more distractible on working memory tasks. So one possibility is that this represents a normalization, remediation of dopamine levels in the striatum, but simultaneously an overdosing of dopamine levels in the prefrontal cortex. And this was interesting because it is an effect that's in some sense diametrically opposite to the effects of, say, kind of analogous drugs like Ritalin, methylphenidate, in ADHD, where what we think, and this is a little bit unclear, but what many people think is that ADHD is accompanied by deficient catecholamine levels in the prefrontal cortex, so that methylphenidate might act primarily to remediate dopamine or adrenaline deficiency in the prefrontal cortex, thereby rendering representations more rather than less resistant to distraction.
And then we can do better on a test or studying.
Exactly. Then we can focus better, be less distractible. Mm-hmm. And in some sense, that's directly opposite to what we see with dopamine-enhancing drugs in Parkinson's disease. So one way to account for these paradoxical effects of these dopaminergic drugs across different people is by taking into account, first, baseline dependency, the fact that the effect depends on where you start off, and second, on where in the brain that is the case.
Yeah, so if I just took a bunch of dopamine in hopes, you know, to perform better on something, I might end up cheating on my wife more, or you know, going to the gambling boats or jumping off bridges because I'm so flexible, right?
Well, I guess that's what you see in Parkinson's disease, right? That in a proportion of people, they start to gamble as a function of these dopamine agents.
I've got to ask my grandma about this, who loves, she really just wants me to take her to the gambling boats these days. And
yeah.
So maybe we'll have to ask her about this.
Although, yeah, the degree to which you want to associate that kind of compulsive gambling behavior with a sense of flexibility is a whole different issue.
Right, right.
Yeah. We've actually recently, it's not published yet, but obtained some really interesting preliminary data demonstrating that gamblers do exhibit increased dopamine levels in the striatum. That's published.
Okay.
They also exhibit compulsive behavior on a reversal learning task of behavioral flexibility. So they're inflexible.
Uh-huh.
But paradoxically, somewhat paradoxically, the relationship between that increased level of dopamine and compulsivity was negative. So that indeed increases in striatal dopamine, which we think might be associated with increase in flexibility, might actually protect against compulsivity.
Huh. I'm glad you're working on all this and not me.
Yeah.
It's so confusing.
Yeah.
It's so,
yeah, exactly. So you're saying the story is done, and many people think the story is done. Dopamine does RL, does habit formation. It's not like that.
So, Nora, do you mind if I ask you a couple questions?
Not at all.
Hard questions, okay?
Just a little bit hard.
Okay. Why do you think that my podcast is so boring?
Because it doesn't have, like, songs and stuff.
Well, that was going to be my next question, is how to make it less boring. Do you think just songs?
Yeah.
Like the Frozen soundtrack or Smallfoot?
Classic.
So much of, like, the theory about neuromodulation, and this is switching gears just a little bit, seems to revolve around dictating what to allocate our resources to, you know, because we got to do it before we become infertile and die, you know. So we've got to like figure out, you know, we have this time on the planet. We're made of meat and liquids and we're going to die. I mean, it seems like, you know, as much or more of our energy is devoted to figuring out just what to think about, what to spend our resources on, than is spent on the actual thinking about the thing that we're deciding to think about, right? You know, once it's decided. And computers don't have this problem, right? Except for in the time domain, you want a computer to go faster and faster, but a computer's not going to die. You know, we don't have infinite energy to feed a computer. And I'm thinking about AI models now, right? But for all practical purposes, we do. They don't need to copulate. They don't need to, you know, they don't need to decide what to think about in order to make themselves more fit and attractive evolutionarily, for instance. I'm digging myself in a hole here. But anyway, I'm good at doing that. So
it's getting better and better.
So the energy demands and, you know, consumption and limitations in brains related to this stability and flexibility, I'm kind of trying to pit that against the potentially limitless energy consumption by machines. And I kind of want to just open that up for you to comment on, because do you have thoughts about that? And maybe this will bring us into the broader questions about AI and how all this is related.
This is a very interesting observation. I mean, and it triggers all kinds of thoughts.
Yeah.
I mean, the first is that the first point I want to make is one that I actually made earlier, which is that it's unlikely that with thinking, we deplete some kind of metabolic resource in the brain. At least we haven't discovered what that metabolic resource will be. So some people believe that that must be the case, and we haven't discovered which resource is depleted.
That we could then replenish, right?
That we could then replenish, exactly. So that rather the cost of thinking is serving as a motivational signal, as a solution, as an optimal solution to trade-offs like the flexibility-stability trade-off. This is an idea that's formalized actually by Sebastian Müslich and John Cohen in some recent work conference proceedings, I believe. In my own words, the cost of control might serve as a motivational signal to open our mind. And that cost of thinking might have everything to do with these neurochemical signals, which contribute to weighting these costs differently, or might compute these costs to some degree, regulate these costs. The fact that this is missing in AI systems, I mean, those artificial systems face this trade-off, right? They face this all kinds of trade-offs.
Give an example, like in terms of like what to work on at a given time, like what problem to solve at a given time.
You can't be. It's hard for these systems to be stable and flexible at the same time. If a representation is maintained, it's hard to update it. But it's interesting. Just a side point for a second. There's this kind of large initiative program here of the physics department interested in neuromorphic computing.
Yeah, cool.
And their motivation is in fact the observation that the brain uses so little energy compared with computers.
Well, that was part of my point. I mean, are we going to have to worry about that in the future, you know? I mean,
yeah, we are from an environmental perspective, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So hardware is just using up so much energy.
But it seems like so much of our evolutionary resources, so much of what is programmed into us is concerned with energy consumption because it's so finite for us. But theoretically, if we don't give a damn about the environment, etc., about energy consumption, there's no reason why we would necessarily have to build in a concern for energy consumption. Let's say we...
Yeah, but so that's interesting, different way of thinking about the problem, right? So that, this is assuming that the brain functions the way it functions in order to conserve energy for, I don't know, reproduction or something. But that's kind of starting from the assumption that the primary purpose of the brain is survival, which is interesting. Which is actually not unlikely, but another way of thinking about some of these, the origin of these of the computational characteristics of the brain is because it allows us to adapt to a changing environment. And that's how these AI systems and the biological systems differ. So the observation that we can change our state adaptively, sometimes be flexible, sometimes be stable, also comes with deficits, right?
Well, so this is like a trade-off. So you can think of narrow AI and very specialized systems that do one thing extremely well, like let's say a self-driving car or, you know, something that processes visual input or something and detects stop signs or something like that, right? I know that's not a great example. But what we're talking about here with the neuromodulation and being able to switch between tasks and be flexible when necessary is very much a property of our general intelligence and probably is more important when we're talking about artificial general intelligence, which is really what we're all eventually talking about as being the more interesting case in building artificial intelligence. So, I mean, yeah, the idea that there is this deficit, like you say, that is just built in inherently. It's an opportunity cost in itself to have to trade off, for instance. And I don't know if you want to comment more about that. I know we're kind of going off the rails, which is great, but...
Yeah, but it's pretty fundamental, so it's fun. What I'm thinking about a lot these days is about the purpose of these limits. The our brains are limited because they solve the problem of adapting to this changing environment. You're coming from it from a slightly different angle and saying that the computation, the metacomputation itself, is costly.
This is what it seems to me. It's a necessary part of our existence, and we spend energy on it. Our mitochondria spend a lot of energy on it.
Yeah, I think this relates to some of these ideas about the opportunity cost representing this average reward rate of the environment, which can be accumulated in a computationally rather efficient manner. These are the ideas by, Yael Niv and Nathaniel.
I'll be talking to Yael soon.
Yeah, although she won't probably prefer to talk about that as much.
I mean, God, I wish you didn't have children. I wish you had more time to talk today. But
yeah, no, well, this is my general problem.
Oh, geez.
First, is this constant competition between wanting to think more and stop and work out a problem and achieve clarity, and then just the pragmatic challenges of
having more than 10 minutes at a time to think about something.
Yeah.
Yes, I have children. I know what you're going through.
Yeah, it's awful. It's a constant sense of frustration.
But it's a beautiful, beautiful thing, right? Right, Roshan?
When I, just before I had my first son, I was so bored. It was horrible. I got allergic, actually, to work. So one thing that keeps me interested is the diversity.
Well, it certainly is diverse.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have a 7-year-old now, right? You just had a birthday?
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, how much of a struggle has it been to you to give up some of your own control?
Well, the kids provide the perfect training ground, right? For letting go of control. You cannot do anything else but let go.
We're scaring everyone at home, but yeah.
Are we?
I don't know. We must be.
No, I think the kids have helped me probably to let go more regularly, to switch tasks, to relax. It doesn't mean that I'm always happy to let go of control. You know, sometimes I prefer to continue to think about a problem for much longer.
Yes.
But I know I can get stuck. And as I said, before I had children, I would continue to think, even though it was no longer productive. Sometimes it's good to let go, come back to it the next day. The work, the representation stays active.
Yes, but my whole thing is that I need more than 3 minutes at a time to think about a problem. And if you're with your kids, you're not going to be working on problems.
Yeah.
So it's pretty fruitless to even let your mind go there, because then you're just going to be interrupted and frustrated.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Pretty soon I'm going to be talking more in depth about ongoing challenges of being a woman in science. Do you have like a particular experience or any experiences that you'd be willing to talk about that reflect the, you know, being a, that where being a woman has been a factor in your career?
Yeah, this is, it's always a sensitive issue, this. I must say that I've not thought about the gender issue very much.
That's great. That's great. That's a great thing.
Yeah. I've not had to think about that, even though I've been one of the few women in many of the organizations that I've been, also now on various, you know, here at the Donders, but also at other advisory councils. And it's only most recently that it's starting to sometimes strike me, the difference, and becoming a little bit more difficult or salient somehow.
Mm.
Yeah, so far I haven't spent too much energy on the diversity, gender diversity issue, apart from just being me. And I notice it has an enormous impact. So most of my lab is female, and I don't think there's anything specific about the topic that would attract particularly women. But so I do think people attract people like them.
So because there are more men than in science, then that attracts more men, you think? Is that the rule you're...
I don't know. I do think that people apply to work with me, maybe unconsciously, because I'm a woman.
Of course, that means that you're a lesser PI because you're a woman, right? You can't lead people and you're probably not as smart either, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I've never been too sensitive about this. You know, I've benefited to some degree from, we had a quota here for professorships, and I was appointed as part of this quota, and I'm not embarrassed about that. I'm also not.
Oh, like a, yeah, that's like a.
You know, quota, it's like a.
Yeah, like an affirmative action sort of thing.
It's an affirmative action, sorry. Yeah, that's right. So our dean decided that. You know, we now, it was high time at our medical faculty, I'm appointed at psychiatry, to appoint women. And so I was part of that. And I think that's good. I notice how it's a vicious circle. You know, if you don't have women in top positions, people won't consider it even possible. Other women won't consider it possible. When I didn't have kids, I had my PhD student tell me they didn't want to stay in academia because they didn't want to have no kids like me.
Oh my gosh, that's not a good note to end on. Okay, no. let me ask you one more science question, and then I'll let you go, because I know you do have kids and you have to get along. Roshan, what is something that you used to believe, and this can be about cognitive control or, you know, your field or science in general, that
right.
That you consider naive now?
Many things, but...
I'm here all day. I can do this all day.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, in relation to what we've talked about, I think... There was a time that I thought that smart drugs, so-called smart drugs like methylphenidate, could not possibly act like true smart drugs because they necessarily bias the system to one state at the expense of another.
Because it's a zero-sum game, right, in the brain.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But actually, right now, I think that that was naive, and that that observation is precisely the reason why they act like smart drugs.
Can you elaborate? Yeah.
It's a bit of an abstract point, yeah, but take an environment that's extremely volatile, that has high opportunity cost, lots of rewarding alternative opportunities. According to one hypothesis, that state is associated with high baseline levels of dopamine. If you now administer a drug, you might overdose a system. It's important for cognitive stability. That's exactly what you want in an environment that's extremely volatile, that has high opportunity costs. You don't want to focus too long on one task. It's a mechanism to adapt to an environment that has certain demands.
So you envision a time when we can do this at will, huh?
Well, I don't know if that's what I would conclude. I think the system might be organized in such a way that it self-regulates itself so that it's adaptive to our environment, and that some of these drugs act in a way that's dependent on a number of factors that allow it to optimize that adaptation.
Hmm. Roshan, this is I say this all the time, that I always run out of time, but in this case, I have so much more stuff to talk with you about, and I don't know how I let it slip away, so I apologize, and You know, hopefully I'm going to badger you and see if I can get you back on the show again in the future. For now, I will let you go. People can find you at roshancools.com or on Twitter at coolscontrol, which is a great Twitter handle, by the way. Anyway, get along now, but thank you very much for being on the show. And hopefully I'll see you in Berlin in a few months.
Thank you, Paul, for the opportunity.
Brain Inspired is a production of me and you. You can support the show through Patreon for a microscopic $2 or $4 per month. Go to braininspired.co and find the red Patreon button there. Your contribution will help sustain and improve the show and prohibit any annoying advertisements like you hear on other shows. To get in touch with me, email paul at braininspired.co. The music you hear is by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thanks for your support. See you next time.